talk on punishment and rehabilitation in the prison system or for people who commit crimes against us. And this usually gives us a lot of energy and a lot of tension about what's this all about. What do we do with these people who we understand have violated not only our social mores and conventions, but have violated our person and our property? Think for a moment about the people that you've read about. I assume none of you know any convicts or people who've offended that have gotten in the press. You may, I mean, it's a possibility, but think for a moment of the people that you've read about that are notorious, infamous, that have committed crimes. And usually those kind of people are that get in the press are the kind of people that commit what I would call heinous kind of things. They're really, I mean, they're really at one end of the spectrum. They're mass murderers. They did some kind of butchering of somebody, rapists, that kind of stuff. Usually violent that gets the real press. The blue collar, white collar, embezzlement, stealing kind of stuff doesn't usually get much press. If it does, Drexel Burnham, that's all on the financial page usually, or it's kind of, we don't quite know what to make of it, and it doesn't generate the same kind of outrage in us that a physical crime does. So think for a moment about the people that you can identify. I identify Juan Corona as one, and a couple other people that I won't mention from California that are infamous. So just think for a moment about those people. What kind of punishment would you personally like to see them have? What kind of punishment do you think they deserve?
How about extermination?
Extermination? Death? Death?
Life imprisonment without possibility of parole.
Life in prison without possibility of parole. Would you like to see them have any corporal punishment? Working on a rock pile? Working in a menial job for the rest of their lives? So you don't want to inflict any physical pain on them, except capital punishment was quick and
I would like to see them have some remorse.
Pardon?
I would like to see some remorse for the crime. I'm not really sure how to get at that.
Get some remorse for the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They actually say that they're sorry, or that. Some rehabilitation of some kind.
Well, I'd like to see some kind of restitution, if there's any way that they could make up for anything they could do to make up for that crime.
All right,
whatever. That's probably not possible in most of these very violent crimes. But you would like to see that.
Okay. What would be do they ever get, is there ever enough punishment for some of these people? I mean, is it ever over? And for what kind of crimes would you say it should be over for? There's enough punishment.
I've always felt that anyone who intentionally takes a life of another really has forfeited their right to continue in this world. I feel he's actually has terminated his his right to call himself a human being. Now, where you get into this great, you know, argument is whether was it intentional or was it for some other reason. And then you get into all kinds of degree of punishment.
Yeah, right.
Would the age of the person make any difference to you?
Well, I wouldn't think so, no. Only by chance if they could be rehabilitated. But who can judge that?
Okay, now, well, let's talk about yourself. What kind of punishment would you expect for yourself? Or your son or daughter?
Are we still in the area of terrible crimes or the whole range?
The whole range.
Okay, because you started out
Good, thank you.
Totally infamous stuff.
Yeah, right. Let's just broaden it out and say for breaking and entering, thievery, car theft, drunken driving, the whole range. What would you want for yourself? What would you want for your relatives? Or your good friends? Or your pastor?
I'd want some way to be that the person who does the crime, whether it be somebody I know or myself, be in touch with the victims. It's sort of along the idea of restitution. But for example, I was burglarized, and Megan wouldn't go into a room alone without me for the next 4 months. I mean, there's no way to give back that kind of peace of mind once your space has been violated. And the person who did it has no knowledge of that. I mean, he's been dealt with by the system, but he was somebody I knew. Mm-hmm. But we've never had any written exchange or face-to-face exchange, and I feel denied. You know, I feel like there's some way I'd like to connect with that person and say, here's what it was like, and you can do this. I want you to know what you put my family through.
Yeah, right.
And whether there's some way he could work with children some kind of restitution to have a sense of what he took away from our household that was never replaced.
Right. When I was burglarized, I couldn't sleep without the lights on in my house for quite a long time. And it's very itchy and waking up constantly.
You want to listen? In the Chicago area, I don't recall the group they talked to our church. There is a group that works on that very thing with the victim and the victimized. No, that's not right. Victim and the one who did the crime, to bring them together to and negotiate and work something out between those two. It doesn't work with everybody, but where they.
Right.
It's kind of like our penal system takes it out and says, here's the justice system, and that's who you deal with, and you deal with defendants and lawyers and whatever.
Right.
But, I mean, that person never really knows, unless there's testimony, and all the testimony I gave was a written document, so there was never any face-to-face. You know, all of a sudden it got real cold and impersonal.
Right.
And that's the impersonal way that they're able to do those crimes. They didn't see me as a person.
That's right.
So I was so depersonalized it was okay to rip off my house or slash my tires or whatever. And I want some way to get back to that personal connection. And that would let me heal and deal with the anger too. Because I've never been able to say directly to that person and then get to the point to forgive them directly. I have to do all that again impersonally myself.
How many of you would want to engage in a relationship like that with somebody who did that to you?
Depending on the crime. If they raped my daughter and stabbed her 75 times, I probably wouldn't want to talk to them too soon.
Yeah. But when I had my car burned up, I knew I could get a hold of the guy, and I was involved in this kind of work then, and I didn't want to deal with him. So I had some reluctance to even just go down to the city jail. So you introduced me to this guy, and let's have a little talk about what you did to my car and why did you do it. So there's some of us who are less able and willing to engage in this than others.
Might not be the same person. Maybe people could be grouped by the type of crime. Maybe you wouldn't want to talk to the guy who actually did it to your car, but maybe you might be willing to use your time to talk to people who have done crimes against property.
You mean somebody else other than the specific.
So there are some alternatives to that. Instead of doing it with my person, I could help somebody else.
So you could say how it felt to have your car burned up, but you wouldn't be saying it to the guy who'd done it. You'd be saying it to someone who'd slashed tires on someone's car.
Yeah, right. Put some distance between me and them so it'd be easier for me to.
But you're sort of a class of victims.
Right.
I have a question. I think when you think about rehabilitation, you need to think about the cause of the problem. And I'm wondering, from your work, have you seen a lot of difference in, say, what makes a person steal a car or vandalize a car and what makes a person rape someone, and the bottom line reasons that criminals do that?
Yeah. There's been some testing that's gone on and says that people who commit different crimes can generally fit into certain kind of categories. The struggle that we're having is, what do we do with that definition after we have it? How do we use it? It's just nice to know that, you know, roses are red, and so that's fine. You know, what do you do with the fact that, you know, burglars, you know, don't want to deal with violence and they don't want to see anybody, and they're basically got maybe some sexual hang-ups that's why they're breaking into things and they're getting an adrenaline rush and they're, you know, all this, and car thieves are this, and, you know, et cetera, down the line. Psychologists and some therapists use that information when they're doing therapy. And the question is, can you do therapy in prison? Given the context that therapy is supposed to be care, and prison is basically for punishment. So the anomaly there is, you know, can you spank your kid and tell him you love him at the same time? The poignant issue that was brought out here for all of us is the fact that with many crimes, immediately when the crime is reported, it's out of your hands. It becomes impersonal. The community has said anything that's judged to be a felony is prosecutable, whether you want to prosecute it or not, or whether you want to have any kind of communication or not. You are now in the legal system, and the legal system comes between you and that person. And the legal system may say, no, you cannot talk to them, because they're going to trial, and we don't want you messing up our possible conviction. And the person defending lawyer may say, no, you can't talk to him yet either, because I want you to stay away so that you'll be a, quote, better witness on the stand if you're for me. I don't want you to talk to this guy. So the legal system comes in, and you may say, as I had a friend who runs a halfway house for women and children in San Francisco, and she fired one of her people, and that one of those people who was violent, she didn't think was very good with the people she had there, and this person was violent, she caught her in the street and beat her up. And Debbie at that point wanted to have some kind of reconciliation going on, and the legal system just took it out of her hands and said, no, she's prosecutable and we're going to prosecute her for assault and battery. And Debbie was very frustrated at that point. So our legal system can intervene and interfere with our attempts to have some kind of, you know, dialogue going on with that. It can't ultimately in the long run interfere, because after the thing is settled, then there are some chances when, you know, to do some reconciling or some talking. But in the meantime, possibly all the damage has been done, and of course the people who commit the crimes don't want to deal with us to begin with, and of course it helps many of them with their sociopathy, who have a hard time connecting with people anyway, who treat people as objects and want to continue treating the world as objects, to commit a crime, not have to deal with anybody, have done the act, and then they're treated as an object by the law. You know, John Jones has done this, and they talk about John Jones as if he's not there, or, you know, this is what he did, and the acts are what he's responsible for. And then this is the sentence, and now you go to prison. And I've known a number of people who said, well, you know, there's a saying, if you can do the crime, you can pay the time. And some people have, you know, figured that out, that that's a possibility for them to do that. And knew a number of men who would go out and, you know, they got tired of being out there, and so they commit their crime and come back in and spend some time there. I think it's hard for many people in the middle class to understand that in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases, prison is like summer camp for some of these guys. That's where all their friends are. That's where the mores that they understand are. That's where the hype is. That's where the cops and robber game goes on. Is that what we want prisons to be for our community?
Well, you asked about crime, if somebody did that to my daughter or so forth. First, I think there's different type of crime, as you have pointed out. Some are against persons, and some are against society, money, and so forth. And I'd like to see a very distinct guideline there. For example, I see no good reason to send anyone here to prison. I'm taking you all have schooling, and you're all, you're good people, basically good people. And let's say you cheat someone out of $1,000 or $1 million or whatever. I don't see prison as any good for that type of person. I would rather see a restitutional sentence in which they continue to work and continue to give to our society, and continue to be a taxpayer, continue to be a part of society, and maybe go once a week to probation and turn over 10% or 20% of their income. And as soon as they don't do that, then they would have to go to prison, because then they're not the type of person I'm thinking about, you see. This is the Bible, they go back to Leviticus, this is what God told the people of his people to do whenever they did something like that, and there was a give it all back plus 20% in one case and so forth. I like that. I think that's very true. A federal judge just wrote me about a month ago because my wife and I were built on a considerable amount of money. And since we were one of the worst hurt, he wanted to know what I recommended. And my son, who was commissioner for the prison system in a certain state, talked to me about it, and he strongly believes in this and is trying to do something in his state concerning restitution of sentences. However, when we come to a violent crime, a crime of murder or physical harm to another person, rape and so forth, there I feel we should do everything in our system to rehabilitate them, everything possible. Because many of these people had three strikes against them when they were born. As you know, I was a prison chaplain. And years and years ago, before you started your ministry, I was. And some of them came to prison and had started crime at the age of 7 and 8 and were prostituting themselves at 11 and 12. Their mother was a prostitute, the father was a drunk. They were brought into this world with not a chance. You and I have had a chance, brought up presumably by Christian parents and with an education and everything, and these kids had nothing but the street. What can you expect of them? I'm sorry, you can't expect a thing of them. That's the way they were brought into this world. That's all they know. We've got to give them a chance to be made like us, shall I say? A chance to look at the better side of life, a chance to have some of the better things. I'm also presuming that we believe work is not a curse, but work is good for us. Work has been given us by the Lord to make us feel important, wanted, needed, appreciated, and loved, to do for ourselves. I think if you give nothing to a person, he's going to get bored. He's going to get himself into trouble. Here at camp, we've got so many things to do, We haven't got time to get into trouble. We haven't got time to be mischievous, I don't think. Maybe there is some problems around here I don't know about. But I feel that prisoners should be at least given an opportunity. If they don't want to, that's their problem. But in the prison I was at, they had a laundry. They had a manufacturing. They made wooden chairs and all kinds of things out of wood. The laundry was a big deal. That was for the whole part of the state there, for police and for hospitals and things like that. We had a farm. That was going down, down, down. I think they're completely out today. But we had cattle and things like that, and it was healthy work, and the people actually liked it. Recidivism was high. They were better off in prison than they were on the outside. On the outside, they had to support other people than themselves. They had the gang still wanted them to do things, and if they wanted to go straight, it was almost impossible. They'd come back to prison, as you say, as a summer camp, but this was constant. They just came back. They didn't want to get out. I was on the parole board for a while. They'd say, "Chaplain, I don't want to get out. I'll break a window just to get back in, or do some crazy thing just to get back in." I don't know if you've had any of these experiences.
Of course. Yeah, this is very common. Who else has got some other feelings about what's been said here?
I'd just like to add that I think a lot of the crimes are drug-related, and so that's the initial problem. The bank robberies, the embezzlement, whatever, to support their drug habit.
Drugs are a major problem and cause for crime.
Well, as long as we're on drugs, I mean, this may be a very moral group, but anybody in here is capable of getting behind the wheel of their car in an intoxicated state and killing or maiming me or some member of my family or someone I love. I mean, I've got relatives who've done it, so I think what we talk about in terms of what we do about drunks and so-called moral people and then what they do, and again, we're struggling with how much do you punish a drunk? Do you throw him into jail the first time with mandatory sentencing? Do you put him through the film program and education and hope that they'll stop drinking because of that? But I see a lot of problems in our culture because of drunks on the road, and the fact, I mean, it's ever increasing. I mean, the statistics of how many people are in an alcohol-altered state who are on the highways with you at any one time, after 6 p.m., even at 6 in the morning now, it's frightening behind a big weapon.
Okay, now
I just wanted to follow up on what this man said. That all sounds good, except that it doesn't solve the economic problem of having to build prisons. And I suppose the cost of maintaining a person in prison will be nothing. But you don't get away from that problem. And if you're going to sell any kind of prison reform problem, it's got to be on the economic basis, as you said. That's the only way you can reach people.
The cost of maintaining a prison is 80% of what it, or 90% of what it costs to build. So if it costs $400 million to build it, it's going to cost that times 9 to maintain it over 30 years.
So you've got to convince people that it's going to cost less. Change it. And you've got to convince them that there are going to be fewer victims, because every edition of the Los Angeles Times that comes out, I think, has at least one letter that says, "Well, why coddle the criminals? Why don't we do more for the victims?" Mm-hmm. This is now the message.
Now, I'd like to ask you, in your experience of being punished, we've all been punished, what worked and what didn't work? And in your experience of being a punisher, we've all punished people, what worked and what didn't work? And how did you feel when you were the punishee? How did you feel when you were the punisher? Can you use any of that experience to help you figure out about what society can do or can't do or should do, or what would you like it to do?
I guess logical consequences and then forgiveness. In both cases, I think has probably had the most impact.
I question whether someone who might have a criminal background would be able to put punishment together, be able to relate it to what they've done. For us, for a normal person, if you punish them for something that they've done, they can put those two together as a consequence of what I did. I'm punished. But then there's those people who can't put together what they've done with the consequences.
Yeah.
And when you take a person like that and punish them, put them in a penal system, you only make them angrier.
Okay, that's a whole other issue, isn't it? What kind of people are we dealing with here? Do we make laws, the death penalty, for instance? The death penalty is made for people like us, so understand that. It's been pretty well proven. You know, it's been proven for the last 20 years, as far as I know, the statistics haven't changed very much, that it doesn't deter people from killing each other. The people that it deters from killing each other are people who wouldn't kill each other anyway. So what are we doing with it? If these people think differently than we do, are we making laws only to satisfy our own understanding of reality and our own needs? But it has nothing to do with them. They don't understand those laws. They don't respond to the carrot and the stick. That doesn't make any sense to them. They can't relate that way. If we're doing that, then who's crazy? And how do we go about finding out what laws do these people respond to if they're sociopathic? How does a sociopath work? If the sociopath is immediate gratification, doesn't understand consequential relationships, is not able to think into the future or the past, does not learn by their experience, then what good are all these laws? And what good is prison?
Well, it prevents him from doing what he did before.
Okay.
Well, they're in there.
Yeah. Well, I guess you have to keep
it. Yeah, and I'm concerned about the person who is caught when he's done a big crime, a rape. I'm talking in terms of crimes of passion, especially.
Okay.
And I understand that the statistics show that there's very little, if any, rehabilitation for continued rapists, that's what has one of the least success rates.
It seems to be the sexual crimes are...
Right. And they have a long record. This has always irritated me, because I'm a social work major, and I've had 17 years in teaching behaviorally disturbed students, special education. And also, I just came from a year and a half over in Korea, where we have no rape and no murder. And when I say no, I'm saying it's really, really rare. It's so rare that it just makes a big headline and everybody gets really up in the air about it. And yet, after living there with those people, I really can't explain why they don't have it, except one thing, we don't have drugs over there, for one thing. Now, what do we do so that we don't have to let that person have a long line of molesting children for years and years and years and years? And I deal with this, and work with this in my work there in the school district that I'm involved with, and I work with the police department, that type of thing. This has, been a problem. How can we keep them safe? I mean, how can we keep society safe and somehow keep them incarcerated or whatever? And why do they have to keep on and on and on, and then all of a sudden do the big one, and then up, and then everybody's angry? Have you dealt with that this week at all?
No.
Should a system be penal at all? Should we have a punishment system? Or should we have a correctional system that deals with where these people are coming from? I talked about my son yesterday. He has this girlfriend, he thinks she's nuts. I'm glad he does. But she got involved in a long situation, which I won't go into, but ended up with this guy with somebody's car. She drove the car around for several days. She had the guy's credit cards. She finally got caught using a credit card, but she drove this car around for several days. And when my son asked her, well, why did you drive this car around? I needed a car. And that's what she said. She said, I needed a car. And she showed him the credit card and says, if you use those, you're crazy. And she stood in the store for 40 minutes waiting for a charge to be approved until the police got there.
That's funny to us because it just doesn't make any sense. But if we take it seriously, then we say, wait a minute, these people don't act and think the way we think and act. And for us to laugh at it only causes us more problems. We say, what's going on here? Why does two people walking down the street, having a great time, all of a sudden turn around, stick somebody up, the woman gives him the purse, and as they're walking away, the kid turns around and he says, kneel down. She kneels down and he shoots right in the head. And they catch him and they said, why'd you do that? He said, well, I don't know, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, that says that there's something radically wrong in the socialization process, in the mental process, and maybe in the genetic process of this person.
There was a In a Richard Pryor comedy routine, he's talking about when he made a certain movie of his in prison. He said he was talking to this prisoner who had gone in and killed the whole family. And he said, well, why did you kill them? He said, they were home.
Now, I submit to you that those answers are telling us something very vital about the way those people think and believe and understand reality. And for us to dismiss that because it doesn't match our reality and say, that's crazy, and laugh at it, or, well, you know, I can't deal with that, is only a way of excluding again and pushing away and making stereotypic, bad guys out of these people that we can then vent our anger and hostility and rejection upon. And not then take a look at what is it that God has done here. Did God make these people? That's a question. You think God made these people? Did God make all things? Does God love all things? Does God want redemption for all things?
Have you ever seen a person like this rehabilitated? Any single person that was that far out the way the rest of us think and feel? Do you think it's possible to rehabilitate such a person?
Okay, then we're into a semantic kind of a game when we start talking about rehabilitation.
Can you bring him around to where he feels the way we do?
Yeah. I don't know that. My hope is, my faith is, that we would try to understand the relationship that we have to that kind of a person. And what I am in relationship to this reality. I think I get caught up very quickly in, they're not me, they don't have the same values that I do, so I have the right to reject them and do whatever I think ought to be done to them. And then I get caught up equally as much in the act that they did, and that awful act. I never, or seldom do I get caught up in, what's God trying to tell me in this thing? Who am I in relationship to this person? What has God made here? And how do I respond as God would have me respond to this reality. That seldom ever occurs to me or to us as a community. It's usually the crime and the person and the rejection. And then, of course, what is the rehabilitation? And the rehabilitation starts from what I have come to, from a misnomer. We're talking about redoing something. That implies, I think, that the person is habilitated, that they have some kind of skill, some kind of normality, some kind of middle class awareness. Okay, and they don't. And if they don't, then how do you habilitate a person who doesn't have that? And can you habilitate somebody who's 18, 20, 30 years old, when all the formative process has gone on beforehand anyway?
Yeah, what I was asking you is whether you've ever seen it happen. Do you think it's possible?
I don't know that. I haven't got an answer for that.
We can't just turn the other cheek.
And I think that's the important issue, is that we can't have people running around who are going to kill us. But then the issue is, if we can't have them running around, people running around who are going to kill us, what do we do with them? Then do we have the right, given the fact that these are all crimes of violence, do we have the right to put them in places where they are going to be psychologically and physically violent? Is that the way we believe life ought to be?
Now you're talking about what happens to them when they are incarcerated.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have any problem incarcerating people, so to speak, that are going to hurt us. That's a given for me. We just can't have people coming around and, you know, molesting and attacking our kids or our friends or me. We can't have it.
Tell us what happens to them when they are there.
Well, what we're doing to them in this country and in a lot of places is we're putting, you know, 500 to 1,500 to more than that, all together in a cramped place that's made for half or a third or a quarter of those kind of human beings to live together. And we've got a staff that's 10% of the incarcerated. And we put them in places where they, for instance, in our prison, when we got into this overcrowding, we had guys living in the hallway and there was one toilet for 80 guys. And is that what, and these guys are unsocialized to begin with, have a emotional level of somewhere between 5 and 15, who do not understand consequential behavior, who are prayers, and who may be violent, and are there because they're disturbed to begin with. And we put them all together in this kind of a situation, what do we expect to come out of that? And then 95% of these guys, I don't know what the average term is now, it used to be about 3 years, they're going to come back on the street. And they live like that for the majority of their time. And then they come back on the street and they move into, you know, our communities. They don't usually move into the middle class neighborhoods, but they come out and start praying in the middle class neighborhoods. And you go down in the areas where they are, because they hang around in the city centers and around that kind of stuff. And they use the public transportation. Is that what we want in our community? I mean, that's the issue. And so far, our answer is overwhelmingly yes, it's what we want. And we want it so bad we're willing to fund and build and pay for bonds to build more of these places. Because we say they're overcrowded, so we need to get them less crowded. But the issue has been is that they never get less crowded. The more space we get, the more we fill it up.
It seems a lot of us are talking in here about we and them, and that we need to rehabilitate them to our way of thinking. And that brings up a couple of questions in my mind, because, first of all, I wonder what I can learn from them, because for some reasons they've been pushed out of society and caused to do the things they're doing. So if they're doing some of the things they're doing because of the way I'm living or because of society, I want to learn from them what I'm doing that's making them offend me or violate me. The second thing is that we're saying that we want them to be more like us, but like you're saying, we're putting them all in one place together. Where are they supposed to learn this behavior that we have, that we think they should have? And so if we do want them to be more like us, or to be in our normal way of thinking, I think we have to think about how that's going to happen. And how is that going to happen if we shove them all in one place? And are we willing then to let them be in our place and to let them begin to see how we live? Because they're not going to learn it, you know, with a step, with a staff of 10 people in a population of 100 or 1,000 or whatever the figures are. And so it just makes me question what the church's role, and as members of churches, as we go out of this place, are we going to be willing to let them see? And, you know, if we're so concerned with changing these people and letting them be like us, if we're the norm, how are we going to do that? Because I don't think it's happening. And I think if we want that to happen, then we're going to have to be a part of that happening. And so I just wonder what people's feelings are on this, especially the people that have spoken up and said that, you know, they need to be more like us. How is that going to happen? And how are we going to be a part of that? And that's what I'm going to think when I leave here.
Isn't there a general cheapening of life, what with abortion on demand, and you're talking about euthanasia? And then, from the viewpoint of evolution, we're not accountable to anybody, and we're just high-class animals. Well, why would we be accountable to anybody?
How do you help people be accountable? That's the issue. How do you help people feel accountability? And that implies, I think, some symbiotic process of attachment. I can only feel accountable to you if I care about you. And if I feel that you and I have some kind of relationship, and therefore I need to take care of that relationship.
Well, our accountability would have to be to the Lord.
Well, if I don't feel accountability to you, I'm not going to feel accountability to God, I don't think.
Some of the things that we can do is learn not to expect these people to react the way that, to things that we react. Like, sit down and be quiet in church. You know? Or like, expecting a certain behavior in school. Those are some things that we can do, because what we do as a society is, because we don't understand these people, we make them angry. Because we expect them, we get angry because we expect them to be what we call normal. But they have a different kind of normal. They don't, because they may have learning disabilities, they don't act and react the same way that we do. In our society, we've learned to put ramps up to our churches so that people in wheelchairs can get in there. And that's great. But it's more difficult to understand when somebody is mentally and emotionally dysfunctional. And we have to learn to understand that. And I really don't know. I know that we need to do it. But I really don't understand how to do it. But I know that we need to do that. Because we need to love these people. Not after they commit a crime. We need to learn to love them before they commit crimes.
And most of them, if any of you are teachers, know that you can identify these kids very early, second grade. And everybody, every teacher I've ever talked to, just they all nod, yeah, we see him. Now, what's better, to spend $25,000 a year on them after they've committed the crime and they're 20 or 30 years old and they've had all this formative stuff that's conditioned them, or to spend, you know, probably $10,000 a year on them when they're in the second grade and carry that on until... And when you're talking about that, then maybe spending that kind of money also on the family that the kids come out of, or on the family units in the community. Some of the families are split up and that kind of business. Are we willing to spend that kind of money? So far, we're saying very clearly and very dramatically, we're going to take our money from education, from health and welfare, from rehabilitation programs in the community, from medicine, public health, and we're going to put it into prison. And we're voting those bonds, and I don't think people understand that clearly, that every time you vote for a bond for prison construction, you're taking money from something else. And the issue seems to be that if you don't put money in prison, then the community is forced to do something else. But if you buy a prison, you fill it. That's just axiomatic. It just happens.
It's exactly what the new drug czar said too. The first thing we've got to do is build a lot more prisons. Take care. That's the only way we can really get rid of the drug people.
Well, we have a czar of the drug war now. So we have a drug war. Instead of looking at the systemic causes of what's happening, why do people buy drugs to begin with? You know, we're just trying to stop it at our borders instead of stopping it inside and saying, why do people want to get high? Why do they want to escape reality?
I guess one reason is we don't have the money. We say we don't have the money. We got it for armament and war and so forth. But we're spending it all on prisons now, so we don't have another $10,000 for a child to spend on the second grader. Isn't that it? I mean,
well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what would happen in, for instance, in the state of California in 1974, around there, Ronald Reagan was the governor, and he decided, for whatever reason, that he was going to cut the prison population in half or more than that, because it was costing the state too much money. So in 1 year, he let out 10,000 people from prison. Just emptied them out. I went over to San Quentin, it was like a ghost town. Couldn't believe it. The crime rate didn't go up one bit. And Ronald Reagan had his money to do something with. I don't know what he did with it, but you know. Now, it seems to me that can happen again. That we could let out, you know, two-thirds of our nonviolent people who are nonviolent people, we could let them out and take the money that we're using right now and use it for something else, for them in the community. The other thing that we forget about, and this just blows my mind away, because I just had never even thought about this. Secretary of the Correctional Agency told me, he says, Nick, do you realize that every guy we have in prison, we lose more money because they're not out there working and paying taxes?
Sure.
We lose more money in taxes than we lose this other way.
You're taking care of his family,
so,
too.
I think I mentioned
it. Because you're taking care of his family, too.
Yeah, going back to your question, I did some volunteer work about 7 years at the Monroe Reformatory in Washington State. And looking at that and looking at the work that we do in school, I think that we need to spend some time working on ourselves as staff. Quick example of at Monroe, we want to do the kind of programs that we've done here this evening in food and whole bit. And the guards, you know, went out on strike because they didn't want us mixing in with the prison. And like you're saying, the young men had to come back out to society, so when were they going to get a chance to learn how to socialize? So again, I'm saying that we need to spend some time working on ourselves as staff, looking at the expectations, and thereby feeding those expectations into change.
Yeah. Now that brings up a couple issues. Number one, what kind of people work staff go to work? Why are we attracted to them? Why do we work there?
Security.
We
always have a job.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's again, as you're defining who commits what kind of crimes, you know, it's pretty. You can start focusing on, you know, in your profession, wherever you're working, you can say certain kind of people go there, and why do they go there? What kind of idealizations do they have? What kind of makeup do they have? You know, backgrounds, etc. And you'll find some common things that tell you something. In prison, the kind of people that work generally in correctional kinds of things, and that includes firefighting too, are people who are fairly rigid, and this doesn't mean it's wrong. They're fairly rigid. They like to see things simplistically. They like to have things organized. They like to have things in order. Now, is that the kind of thing that people in prison need? I think some of it is, yeah. But then we also have some, and that, and the extension of that finally though is absolute control and tyranny. That there's a healthy side of control, and then there's that tyrannical side of control. Now prison, do any of you know about the experiment they did at Stanford where they had this fake prison, they put people together and they had guards and none of them done it, and it proved to be that the guards, the people who played the guards became more and more controlling and more vindictive. And these people had no training whatsoever, so I'm not saying that this is. And that the people that were confined started doing more and more testing of that control to try and break the control down. So they weren't, it just proved to be some kind of a crazy mix that was going on. And they wanted the experiment to go on for, I think it was 30 days, and they finally had to terminate it within 3 weeks because it was getting so vicious. Now, neither side was trained, and you know they didn't have an MLU, but the thing is there. This craziness that happens with us. That the rigid people get in there and they become more rigid and more controlling and more demanding and more vindictive and more punitive and feel more threatened when their authority is disobeyed. I mean, I saw it in prison. First of all, we had no fence, and then we had one fence, and then we had two fences, then we had electronic stuff, and then we had barbed wire, and then we had razor wire, and then we had one door, and then we had two doors, and then we had four guards, and it's like the missile, it's like the arms race, it just never stops. The paranoia just keeps going and going and going. How do you stop paranoia? How do you help people open up, become giving, become resilient?
How about the penal system in foreign countries? Have you made any study of that? Maybe Sweden and Norway and Germany
I only know what a couple of my friends tell me in their experience. And in the Netherlands, it seems that they don't keep anybody in a confined situation, a strictly confined situation, I shouldn't say, for more than 18 months. There are some people that they confine continually because, as I say, they're uncontrollably violent. But mostly, 99% of the people they do not keep confined more than 18 months. And the parole system there is a voluntary parole system. That is, the community people decide to be and volunteer to be the parole agents. And it's a one-on-one situation. And that has proved to be very successful. Now that's direct community involvement, and it's a different community. The statistics say that whenever you have more than 50 people confined in one institution and the staff is not one-on-one or maybe two-to-one, you've got problems. But these people need constant attention. And any sociologist knows that the dominating community, the dominating mores are going to take over the society. So when you got 500 convicts and you got 200 staff, the values of the community are obviously going to be conflict.
Well, could that work in this country, do you think?
Well, yeah, but we don't want to do it. So far, we haven't wanted to build small prisons. In the state of California, we decided to build small prisons. No more than 500 man units. And what do? We put 500 man units together. And one chaplain in each one of those units, and one chaplain for the whole outfit.
It sounds like some of the same things for adult psychology ring true for children, child psychology. You know, when we punish people, if you punish puppies or children, you have to punish them almost directly after they do something, because they forget. And if you somebody commits a sin and they're punished a year later, they forget. And also, children the same way. If you deal with, you get a class of 35 children, and they can be really chaotic, but then you take the same children that are being chaotic, put them in groups of five, and relate to them as individuals, and they're a lot better. You know, it's because they're not dehumanized, and everybody who works with kids will tell you that. I mean, it's a lot nicer to tutor one child than it is to deal with 45 children in a classroom. And the
That's
kids,
right.
the kids will react better.
I'm going to change the emphasis a little bit. Does somebody else have something they want to say before I... What time we got? I was in Chicago in 1965 when the freedom stuff started. And I was part of a training center, and we were going out and marching and all that kind of stuff. And people were getting arrested. And they were going to the city jail, and they were staying for a couple hours to a week or whatever. And this was happening throughout the country. I had great hopes at that time that the middle class people who were now involved with this struggle and were feeling excited about this struggle, and who were getting arrested and were going to these county jails and seeing that there was one toilet for 15 people and some of them had to sleep on the floor, and that they couldn't wash their clothes unless they washed their clothes in the toilet and they were getting fed beans and rice, would come out of there and say, oh my God, what is our community doing to the people in prison? But what happened was that they came out and that experience didn't seem to affect them one darn bit. They were impervious to it. They came out, some of them told me about it, but they were impervious to the experience. And they didn't seem to feel any responsibility for saying, my God, you know what we're doing to human beings in there? Somehow they said to themselves, this was summer camp and we had a great time in there and all my buddies were there with me and we did this thing and we didn't pay any attention to any of the other people that were there. Now, it stunned me because I thought these people who were so socially aware and so concerned about rights would say something. But it told me very clearly that people who offend us have no rights, they're nobodies. And they deserve what they get. And I don't know how to get around that. And now we're at the end, and we can go on with this forever. And the other sad side of it, tragic side of it for us, is that most of these people are minorities. They're blacks, they're Chicanos, they're Indians, some gypsies, and some of the other minorities that we don't even know about, they're so small. Those are the people that we put in prison because we don't identify with them. Now, as a Christian community, what kind of responsibility do we have for this? Do we care about the least of the least of the least? And do we want to put money, take all the money that we're going to use on the drug war and say, that's craziness. These people who are going to prison because of drugs are trying to escape the reality of the communities that we built and we live in and we have responsibility. Even if we live on the north end of town and don't have anything to do with it, that's our community down there. And we've segregated just as much as South Africa has segregated it. And those prisons are just as much South Africa as anything else. Very complicated issue, and it's very depressing for me. And if there's any cause for guilt, that's where my guilt is around that stuff.
And then, too, we have been sitting here talking about it, but we leave here, and the danger is that we will forget that we've even talked about it and go on living as we have done before.
Well, yeah, I don't want to lay any more guilt. I want to energize you and say there are some things you can do.
Yeah, sure there are.
You can vote against the bond issues for more prisons. You can be talking about health and welfare and educational issues and be concerned about that. You can be looking at the crimes that you read about in the paper and simplest thing you can say to your neighbors when the crime comes up is, what do you suppose caused that person to do this? That changes the whole emphasis of the conversation. What do you suppose caused that person to do this? Who do you suppose his parents were? Where did he grow up? What was happening in the community he came out of? Those are small things, but they can be a big... And then, you know, when you hear things about the prison system, you can say, do we really need that system? What do we need that system for, rather than accepting the... And the other part of it is that if you... and everybody doesn't have the ministry of going into prison, so I don't want you to feel that this is your ministry. It doesn't have to be. It's not, you know, we all do our own thing. God calls us for different things. But the one thing is that prisons should be more open to the public. We should know what's going on in there. And every time you feel that there's something being cut off, you should ask the question, what's going on behind those walls? Why don't they let more volunteers in there? And they'll give you all the security reasons. You know, can't come in because they're taking drugs in. The issue of taking drugs into prison is a staff issue. It's not a public issue. Staff brings all or the majority of that drugs into prison, not the volunteers normally. There are some, and they make a big deal out of the volunteers doing it. In all my years in prison, in the religious community that came into the prison, and the religious volunteers were 90% of the people that came in, there was only two or three instances where I knew that any drugs had been brought in by those volunteers. The rest of the drugs are brought in by the staff.
Are they corrupt? I mean, do they make money at
well,
it?
Well, yeah, of course they do.
Sure. But
you can say they're corrupt, but we've caused the tension and built the situation for that corruption to take place. So it's not just saying the staff is corrupt. We've done something there to cause this corruption by the very system that we've built.
Somehow I feel that the system perpetuates itself because I hear again and again among, quote, Christian groups, the talk more there than anywhere else about punishment and vengeance on those people who have violated the mores of the community or the society. And I hear that so strongly coming from the lips of those people who are, quote, Christians, unquote.
Yeah, right.
That thing seems to perpetuate what's going on. We got to get those brothers.
That's right.
And we do it again and again and again, and we never want to go beyond that statement and see consequences of what happens with that, and so therefore perpetuate itself. And you know, the simple statement is somewhere in Scripture that says, "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord." We as Christians forget that. We want to solve this problem very simply, and it's just simply get those people, vengeance on them, get them, teach them. And again, then we come forth with this whole idea that you've raised, does it accomplish what we assume it will accomplish? No, it does not, because we're talking to something that doesn't, to people who do not respond in that way.
Right.
But I think that's been our history. You know, I know it's simplifying, but I've heard it so many times now. What caused Hitler to get power in his situation? One of the big factors was that there was a high crime rate, there was a lot of disturbance in society. And people were frustrated with that, and they wanted a simplistic answer to it. And Adolf says, "I'll take care of it. Give me that power." Gave it to him. I know that's a simplistic comment, but I...
No, that's. I mean, I feel that's another issue, that another guilt that I carry. As a leader in the Christian community, a pastor, have I been able to exemplify and teach forgiveness? If that's not what the Christian community is about, and if the leaders of the Christian community can't do that, and the followers don't act that out, I think, what kind of responsibility have I done? What have I done for my leadership to you? What have your pastors done to you?
Is there also an issue there that is very vague and gets clouded up between forgiveness and consequences of behavior? I think sometimes people talk in terms of, well, forgive them. What they assume that means is there's no consequence then for what was done. And I think to clarify that, because I think again and again, both God of the Old Testament and Christ in the New Testament, says there are consequences. And that has nothing to do with forgiveness. Forgiveness is something that is granted and given, but there are still consequences for what I have done. We should not confuse those two things. I think we should still understand that God still...
Well, God bless you all as we all try and deal with this issue.
Thank you.